I have come here to chew bubblegum and kick ass. And I'm all out of bubblegum.
Call me Snake.
With blackest eyes, the devil's eyes. Purely and simply evil.
You're out of your
mind, Wang.
God bless you.
What do we do?
Hello out there and welcome back to Precinct 13, a podcast about the movies, music, and mind of John Carpenter. I'm Nick Rocco Scalia, one of your two co-hosts, joined as always by your other co-host, Christopher Oliphant. How's it going, Chris?
Fantastic. Hello, everybody.
We have really hit a milestone on this show, I feel like. We covered the first Carpenter classic over the last 2 weeks.
Yeah, we made it through Halloween. My God.
Literally and figuratively, we've made it through Halloween.
Yeah, and it's I gotta say, I think we covered it pretty well, but still there is just an infinite amount of subject matter to discuss when it comes to Halloween, man. What a film.
Yeah, it was really enjoyable. I mean, this is the most that I've ever watched it in one season, and I'm already sort of looking forward to seeing it again.
Right, so here's the weird thing. This next movie that we're talking about, Someone's Watching Me, was actually... produced by Warner Brothers and aired on NBC shortly after the release of Halloween. So this comes on the air November 29th, 1978. But for those of you listening that aren't aware, it was actually filmed prior to the making of Halloween. So really, if we're looking at Carpenter's body of work in terms of things that were actually filmed in order, this came right after Assault on Precinct 13, correct?
Yes, and it was his first real studio film because, like you said, he was contracted by Warner Brothers to write this. So after those two independent productions, I mean, Dark Star is basically a student film. Assault on Precinct 13 is a very low-budget independent film. And this is his first taste of that big studio influence and cash and basically the way they do things. And the way they do things sometimes is a little bit counterintuitive because, yeah, this movie came out a week after Halloween premiered. And I don't know if that's better or worse for the film itself, but it right. does show that they can kind of drag their feet in a way that an independent company, you know, the other films that he did, they basically had a smoother, I guess, progression from script to screen and release.
Right. But I always think about that from a filmmaker's perspective. Like, I know that the mechanics of making the film for TV inside a studio has got to be way different than doing an independent feature film or even a major feature film. But it's got to be kind of a bummer to make a movie and not get a theatrical release, right? You know, like you make the movie and then NBC airs it like one night. And if you saw it, you saw it. If you busted out your VHS, geez, back then, was VHS like a household product at that point in 1978?
I'm not sure. I mean, I think it existed, but I don't think it was a thing that was in every home and that people were taping stuff the way they did right. years later.
Yeah, like who has the like blank VHS tape with Someone's Watching Me on it or something, you know? Like, so this movie has been called, I was reading, it's been called Carpenter's Lost Film because of the fact that after it did air, it never really got any media mass production as far as DVD or Blu-ray until just like 2 years ago. So for a long time, the only way that you could see this was to rent it digitally or, you know, get it from whatever streaming service you could find it on. I do have the Blu-ray. I bought the Blu-ray and it does have some new interviews on there with like Charles Cyphers and Adrian Barbeau. I mean, we can get to a little bit more of that later, but I just always, it's weird how we look at TV movies differently than we do feature films. You know, like, I don't know why in my mind I'm always thinking that for some reason it's going to be like inferior or, you know, just not the real thing. And I don't think that's fair for me to view them that way.
Well, it's a very different thing now also. I mean, we still have TV movies. I was thinking about this when I was watching this film. I mean, our TV movies now are on services like Hulu and Netflix, and a lot of times those companies will pick up a film that was intended for theatrical release, and, you know, it's still in the widescreen format. It still looks like a film in some ways that something like Someone's Watching Me doesn't. But there is still that kind of distinction, and there's also that question of whether you go into it expecting a little bit less quality than you would get from a theatrically released film. However, I mean, we're talking about the 70s here, and there were some really great TV films of the 70s. I mean, you could really do an event movie back then and promote the hell out of it in TV Guide and whatever magazines people were reading, and you could get a huge audience for something like Brian's Song or what's the one? There's a, I think it was a mini series from the early 80s about nuclear war and sort of the consequences of what a nuclear war would be. And I think it was the most watched television event of all time. So you could definitely get some traction for something like this. And, you know, the only problem there is you don't have the permanence that you have now, where you'd see it once, you'd fondly remember it maybe, and you'd be telling people about it years later, and they'd really have no way to see it.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a great point. But I think there is a significant amount to be said about this film as far as, you know, just where it lay. We're still at the very, very beginning of John Carpenter's career here. So I think I'm ready to start talking about Someone's Watching Me. Are you ready, sir?
Yeah, I think we should. This is the beginning of the end of his first decade in filmmaking. And what a decade it was for John Carpenter. Some might say it's his best decade of filmmaking. All right, so we will be right back to get into Someone's Watching Me.
1 week from tonight, she's young, beautiful, successful, and has everything to live for. But someone wants her dead.
Hello?
Lauren Hutton, David Burney, and Adrian Barbeau star in a chilling tale of suspense and terror. A twisted maniac is at large. Can he be stopped before it's too late? Someone's Watching Me next Wednesday on NBC.
All right, we are back. You just heard a little bit of the promo, trailer, commercial, I don't know what you want to call it, but that was voiced by the legendary Casey Kasem, who I guess just landed the job to do all of these back in the day.
That's incredible. I don't know if I would have ever been able to make that distinction upon hearing that, but now that you mention it, yeah, I guess that is definitely him.
It is the Kasem-Carpenter connection that I don't think lasted much longer than just this one little thing that they did.
Right. So Nick, we've talked about sort of how this movie came to be a little bit. I guess this was, so it was initially called High Rise, and this was written by John Carpenter as well as directed. One thing I thought was kind of interesting is I was watching an interview with him, and he was talking about how he read it. It was a newspaper article that inspired him to write this. It was based on true events of about a woman who was being stalked by someone, I think, in Chicago. And at the time, the whole Peeping Tom thing, I guess, kind of concept hadn't really been explored that much yet in film.
Well, except for Peeping Tom, the I believe it's a 1963 film, the Michael Powell, Emmerich Pressburger.
Except for Peeping Tom. Yeah. No, that's fine. But it wasn't like, you know, today everything is, you know, out there. Like, there's so much more that's been done.
Yeah. This wasn't a cliche yet.
Right. That's what I was, that's how I was trying to phrase that. But, yeah, so based on a script that Carpenter wrote called High Rise, do you want to give a crack at the plot summary here, Nick, or do you want me to go ahead and just break it down?
Yeah, I think we can cover it pretty quickly. So it's about a woman named Lee Michaels, who's played by Lauren Hutton, and she basically is a live TV director, which is kind of an interesting job, and we do get a little bit of the behind the scenes of that. And she's just looking for a new place to live and finds an apartment in I guess I want to call it like an early version of a smart building. Like, it's got computer controlled lights. It's got all this like fancy technology that in 1978 would have really sort of blew people's minds. And it's a high rise apartment building across from another high rise apartment building. And what she doesn't know at the beginning of the film, but what we, the audience, know is that a woman was spied on by someone who was making obscene phone calls and spying on her with a telescope, and she ended up committing suicide. And she doesn't know that yet, but that's what the cold open of the movie is. And immediately after that, she moves into this building and basically goes about her life. She's looking for a new job, so she gets together with a smaller scale TV station and very, very quickly gets hired for a job there. She's just that good at directing live TV. And very quickly, she's living in this lovely apartment. I mean, it's a wonderful sort of, it's got a huge picture window, which of course becomes a very big problem later on. And she finds herself menaced by this same person who is calling her and leaving creepy messages. He bugs the apartment and basically starts, I guess we want to say, remotely stalking her from across the way.
Yes.
And so she is forced to fight back and to do something about it. And that entails a lot of different things. It starts with just closing the curtains.
Yeah, you might want to start there.
And basically, when she realizes that closing the curtains is not enough, she has to fight back and sort of investigate this guy and where he comes from. And there's a little bit of a Hitchcock Rear Window thing happening. There's a lot of voyeurism in this movie. There's sort of, you know, some points to be made about like the male gaze and stuff like that. I mean, in some ways, it's kind of a progressive movie and also kind of drawing, I think, very deeply on that Hitchcock sort of idea of someone watching you and how threatening and imposing that can be. Also, how many times did that song, I know it's called Somebody's Watching Me, the Rockwell song from the early 80s, but every time I think of the title of this movie, I can't help but hear that song in my head. Is that true of you, Chris?
No, I'm not even familiar with it. So
you've got to know that song. It's on every like stupid Halloween playlist that they put on Spotify or anything like that.
Okay, I probably just don't know it by title then. I'll tell you what, I'll listen to it after the show, or maybe shouldn't I? Because then it will just be an annoying jingle that'll be stuck in my head every time I think of this movie.
Oh, probably, but it's a really good song. It's one of the greatest, I think, one-hit wonders ever. It's a really good song.
Yeah. Well, it should be said that, yeah, you nailed that. I mean, so Lee Michaels, again, there's that name Michael coming up. He really likes Michaels.
Oh, he has a lot of fun with names in this movie, and we'll definitely talk about that, too.
Yeah, so Lee Michaels, it takes place in Los Angeles. Yeah, I mean, you nailed it. She gets the directing live television gig. She's a stunning woman. She's very attractive, and I love that. Like when she's at the right after she has her first gig at the radio station, and that's when we're also introduced to Adrienne Barbeau, who plays Sophie. And would later on end up getting married to John Carpenter shortly after this.
Right, and they met on the set of this movie, I believe.
They met on the set of this movie, and she was in, was it Maud? He saw her in some other television piece and was impressed with her work. But, yeah, so she goes to work, hastily gets hired sort of on the spot after this, you know, this quick trial that they do live. And she's talking to Sophie kind of backstage. I love that scene where the guy comes in and he's just like, he's just trying to take her out on a date. Like, so he's going about it just the wrong way. He's like super aggressive about everything.
Well, can we talk about that? Because that's a note that I made a bunch of times in my notes about this movie. There is so much sexual harassment happening in this movie. I mean, it's a very, it's kind of a feminist movie in a lot of ways. Like, it's basically about female characters who are just surrounded by guys who are, you know, at worst creepy stalkers that are looking at you with a telescope, and at best just kind of these lecherous, like, sleazy. I mean, it almost reminded me of Anchorman, actually. Like, all these scenes at the TV studio. I mean, I know Anchorman's obviously a parody of this sort of workplace culture, but it's played not for laughs here. It's played pretty straight. This coworker, I think Steve is his name, and he's just, like, constantly hitting on her. There's a guy that comes up to her in the bar in one scene who's just, like, a real lech, and, you know, mm-hmm. it's kind of about these women trying to survive in this very predatory world. And I think that theme gets across very well across this movie. I mean, just to talk about the Lee Michaels character a little bit. I mean, she's a very strong sort of independent woman. And I love that scene in the bar because she's sitting having a drink by herself. This guy comes up to her and just, you know, hits her up with a really cheesy, shitty pickup line. And she just dismisses him outright. I mean, she cuts him down to size and he just disappears. And then immediately after that, she goes over to this other guy who's sitting there, and he ends up being a major character in the movie, but there's a gentleman who's just sitting there reading the newspaper, having a drink, and she goes over and starts hitting on him, basically. And not that she's aggressive about it, but she kind of takes control of the situation, and she's clearly a character who's not going to put up with crap from a lot of guys, but is going to gravitate towards someone who is not sort of predatory like that. And I thought that was a neat character choice. One thing I will say about Lee Michaels, and it's not so much, I mean, I think the performance is very, very good. I like Lauren Hutton in this movie a lot, and I want to talk about a lot of stuff that she does. I think her dialogue in the first third to the first half of this movie is so overwritten. It was really starting to annoy me after a while. So she does this thing where she's constantly talking to herself and, like, referring to herself by her own name. She's like, come on, Michaels. And it's very sort of overdone. And, you know, I was kind of off put by it. And, like, you could tell in that performance she's doing other things too. I mean, there's subtleties there that work really well. I think she's a very good actress, but the script is not serving her well. And I wonder if it's because, you know, we've talked about Carpenter on the show a lot as a huge Howard Hawks fan. And one of the things that Howard Hawks did a lot of was these screwball romantic comedies about these kind of fast talking, tough talking women. And it's really, really good in Hawks. Like, have you ever seen Bringing Up Baby? That doesn't seem like a movie that you would be familiar with, but it's a great movie.
No, I have not, but I can relate to what you're saying because he's creating the Hawksian female lead characters within both Lee Michaels and Sophie to a certain degree.
Yeah, it's less obvious with Sophie. I think she's a little bit more human right from the get-go, but Lee is very, she feels like a character early on, and it prevents me from sympathizing with her as much as I want to. And then later on, when things get tougher for her and she sort of becomes more human, like in that respect, like she's actually dealing with problems and not just kind of doing this thing where she's talking to herself a lot and being sort of forced into this Hawks heroine sort of role, I think it's much, much better. And obviously, you know, you can't have screwball comedy dialogue later on in a film that gets this serious where people are actually getting stalked and murdered and stuff like that. And I think Carpenter just handles that a lot better in terms of the script. I was really, really just sort of, I couldn't take it after the first 20 or 30 minutes of this movie. I just kind of wanted that dialogue to stop, or I guess not dialogue, those that monologuing to herself that she does. I mean, I like the way she talks to other characters, and I sort of like the toughness that she shows, but you know, like, we get that she is alone and we get that she's very witty, but I don't think anyone would ever talk to themselves that way. I think they'd be committed if they were.
Right. That's interesting. I mean, I definitely noticed that. It didn't bother me. I didn't notice it like it was, being overdone. Now that you mention it, maybe I would pay more attention to that, but
oh, it's rough. I mean, I told you, I saw this movie twice, and I watched the first half hour, I think, three times, just because my internet connection was spotty that first time, so I wanted to see it sort of all the way through, and it was just really, really noticeable to me. Although there's one great line delivery she has, again, talking to herself. She walks into her apartment at one point, and it looks like someone has been there. There's sort of a hint that someone has broken in, and she's talking to the burglar, which she doesn't actually think. She's like, hello, Mr. Burglar. And she's got this great line delivery about how he should know that she studied with Bruce Lee before he died. And I was like, oh, cool. Little Bruce Lee reference in this movie. So, you know, Carpenter is obviously paying tribute to films that he likes here. And, you know, I love filmmakers who do that. I just think he takes it a little bit too far, at least in the first half. And it does definitely get better later on. I wanted to mention that because otherwise I think this performance and this character are really, really good. And she does sort of establish herself as a good Carpenter heroine by the time this movie's over.
One line that she says to herself that makes me laugh is when, you know, her and Paul are like their relationship's starting to heat up a little bit, but she's very straightforward with him about like, hey, I'm not ready to do anything serious yet. I'm sorry. It's just me. And he's like, oh, that's no problem. He actually has a great line about how he's like, I've got plenty of time or whatever. I mean, this guy, David Burney playing Paul is an absolute sweetheart to her in this movie. And, you know, so they don't get romantic that particular evening and he leaves and she walks over to that the mirror in her bathroom and she just looks at it and says, you're one of the world's biggest bozos or something like that. Like, I don't really know exactly what the line is, but the way it's delivered, I laugh out loud every time she says that line.
See, that's interesting because I didn't like that. I thought she handled that situation really well and there was nothing to be like embarrassed about or, you know, she wanted to take things slow and he agreed to it. So what's wrong with that? How does that make her a bozo? She does. I do like the way she says that word, but yeah. I don't know. I don't think it made a lot of sense to me.
That's because he's such a good guy and, you know, it's not, she's holding herself back from, you know, what to taking the relationship to the next step, I think. And it's not just him. Like, again, he's not like the other characters in this movie, like that guy, Steve, who's freaking calling her like so obnoxiously, like time after time, trying to, you know, take her out to dinner or accomplish whatever it is he's trying to accomplish.
Well, that's kind of what I was saying before, right? Like, there's no likable male characters in this movie except for this one very, very likable male character. But otherwise, right. men are scum in Someone's Watching Me. And like I said, I mean, I think that is thematically appropriate. I think that actually works and just sort of makes this world feel more threatening. I mean, there's the actual threat of this stalker character, but also, I mean, the just maleness in general is pretty seedy and pretty awful in this movie.
Right, and so one thing we should mention, so Adrienne Barbeau, she plays Sophie. She doesn't really have like a huge role in this movie as far as screen time, but she's definitely a significant character in the movie and she is top billing in it. And that's another interesting dynamic is that we learn very early on in the movie that that she's a lesbian because there's that exchange between her and Lee where she's like, oh, you know, what did your ex-man do to you? And she's like, oh, it's a long story. How about yours? And she's like, oh, it wasn't a man, you know, and don't worry, you're not my type sort of thing. And I thought that was kind of an interesting character choice, too. And then after watching some of the extra stuff on this on the Blu-ray that I have at the time, you know, back in 1978, that was a, you know, sort of a bold thing to do. To, you know, to have a lesbian lead in your movie without, you know, making fun of them or exploiting them in some kind of way and having them be like, you know, a strong character in your movie. So I think there's got to be a dynamic there for that too, right? I mean, it wouldn't just be random.
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of interesting, like, because she's a neat character and I really like her. She's an extremely likable actress. It's a really good performance. And she does, she's a very, very good friend to Lee right from the get-go. She's sort of this, yes, this other woman in this very male-dominated world. And she really helps her out with this job that she gets and eventually becomes her confidant and her ally when things get really serious later on. I mean, it is a progressive idea that they do here and points to Carpenter for including that and getting away with it. I mean, you really couldn't even do this stuff on TV a lot back then. I mean, it's I think it was sometime in the 90s when you had the first like woman on woman or man on man kiss on TV, and it was a very chaste sort of thing, and that was a huge deal. People like protested that. So you know, this is decades before that. I will say it's not the most delicate or thoughtful handling of her sexuality in this movie. I mean, it is, you know, that line that you were mentioning, like, oh, don't worry, I'm not going to hit on you and stuff like that. Like, she has to be sort of very, guarded and very defensive in a way that I don't know that this character would be in real life. But, you know, I guess we do, like I said, we had to give him some points for at least making that a part of her character and treating her fairly. I will say, though, I mean, one of the things, we're kind of jumping ahead a little bit here, but one of the things I really did not like about this film is the way that character's exit happens. Sophie is kind of the sidekick the whole way through, and then there's a moment later in the film where she is in Lee's apartment, and Lee makes her way. She figures out what apartment across the way this stalker is spying on her from. So there's this neat sort of Hitchcock scene where they're in separate apartments and they're in contact with one another, and it's very Rear Window again. I think it's directly inspired by Rear Window, and Sophie is killed in that scene, and to me, I feel like it's a bad character choice for both of them because it's really kind of Lee's fault.
And totally.
I don't think it's really fair to either one of them to sort of handle that way. And I know you need some violence in this movie. I know, you know, to sort of escalate the threat. And I think Carpenter does a great job of escalating the menace and escalating the threat from the beginning of this film where there's not too much. And it sort of builds very steadily until I think a very intense climax. However, I really don't like the way that this character is just sort of cast aside and her death becomes kind of the central thing in the movie. But I don't think it's a good idea to do that to your protagonist, right? Like if Lee hadn't left her there, if she hadn't sort of made her come along in this investigation that she's doing, then Sophie wouldn't have died. And it makes me feel just sort of less sympathy toward the main character. And that's a point when we want to be the most sympathetic toward her. But you know, giving her that culpability and you know, she's totally indirectly responsible for it, but I don't love that choice. There's a number of things in this script that I definitely take some issue with.
Yeah, I can see that. Here's how I'd kind of like to approach this. Like, what we've established is that Lee Michaels buys this house, loves the view, gets the job. What starts happening? What are the first few weird things that start happening to her, right? Like, she starts getting mail from this company called Excursions Unlimited. Right. And is the first thing she gets a telescope? Is that the first?
Well, the first thing she receives, it's a fun plot device. It's so stupid and so ridiculous. It's played pretty straight, and it's a fun idea, but it doesn't really make a lot of sense. Maybe things were very, very different in the 70s, and that's just our sort of modern blinders. But she receives randomly in the mail this thing that says, you are going to be sent on a 6-month vacation around the world.
That's right.
No, I'm sorry. It's a 6-month vacation, and we're going to send you presents, which is a weird way to say this. We're going to send you presents that give you clues to the destination. And if you can guess the destination, then you get to go on the 6-month vacation. Like, who would get that? And who could go on a 6-month vacation? Like, she has a job. We've already established that. I don't think this TV network that just hired her is going to be too happy with her being gone for a half a year. So,
hey, listen, I know I just started like today, but I need 6 months off. Starting, you know, after I win this thing. Yeah, it's a good point. Like, why couldn't they
just written it? Random company just sent me a thing about a free vacation.
Yeah, that's fair enough. Fair enough. But the
I thought it sounds like a timeshare presentation. Like, oh yeah, you're gonna get a free 6-month vacation, but you have to sit in a timeshare presentation for the entire 6 months or something like that. Yeah, it's not the cleanest, neatest plot device, but it does sort of start off, like you were saying, this stalker plot that happens. So she receives this thing in the mail, and then she starts to get these quote-unquote presents, and the first one, of course, is a telescope, which that also doesn't make sense, because if you are stalking someone via telescope, why would you send them a telescope when you know they're going to be able to use that to find you, right?
I think that part of it was
maybe he wants to be watched.
Yeah, and I think part of that is also just part of the psychology of people that are madmen, right? Like they like taking risks. They want to get caught, or maybe they're just literally trying to play with you and give you clues that it's like to make it so blatant. Like this is how I'm spying on you. You know,
well, we should also describe the setting, right? Like, this is two high-rise buildings across from one another, and both of them have basically hundreds of apartments visible, and they all have these huge picture windows, like I was saying. So it would take her a while to find this guy, probably. But still, it just seems it's a little easy there, don't you think? I mean, that is what ends up happening in the movie, is she does spot this. I don't know if she sees him, but she sees the apartment. She sees, you know, a very obvious place where the spying is happening.
Yeah, I can't remember what the exact scene is that triggers her to finally understand that, but so she starts getting these weird things in the mail, like a telescope, like you know, a pair of underwear.
It's a swimsuit, right? So that's supposed to be a clue to the destination. I guess it's going to be someplace tropical.
Yeah, and so simultaneous to her getting these gifts, like, her phone will ring. There's a lot of phone ringing in this movie.
Oh, yeah. Becomes a real device in this movie. It becomes a real tension-building thing.
Yeah, and, you know, usually her receiving of the gift will be quickly followed up by a phone call of some creep on the other line who will, you know, just say something like, oh, you know, like, hope that fits well. Bye. And then just like hangs up, or, you know,
he does have a great obscene phone call voice.
Yeah.
It's a little bit distorted. It's got a little bit of I don't know what you call the effect that's on it, but it definitely does not sound like someone just speaking clearly into a phone. And it's real ominous and kind of scratchy. And yeah, I mean, this guy,
he's a total I mean, he's like, I think at one point he's like, that even might be the line where she figures out, you know, that she is actually being watched in real time, is that he says something like, I liked you better with the robe off, or something like that. And that's when she's like, because she just put on her robe, so she's like, what? And then there's a scene where it, like, zooms in on her, and she turns around and realizes, oh, my God, I'm being watched right now.
Yeah.
And we learn later on in the movie that he was going in and out of her apartment. This ends up becoming a good amount of clues for them to get some evidence as to who this person is, because obviously it has to be somebody that, because anybody can spy on you from across the way with a telescope, but who has keys to the building, who has access to, you know, the electricity.
Well, right, because he's doing more than spying on her and sending gifts. He's leaving stuff at the front desk. He's controlling the lights. I mean, they do sort of make it a plot point, like I was saying before, that this is a smart building, that, like, everything is computer controlled. Everything can be remotely controlled. We saw that a lot in movies later on, but I mean, this might be, I don't know if I had seen that in a movie as old as this one in 1978. Where, you know, the building itself can be sort of used against you. And, yeah, there's, like, all kinds of access that he has. And, you know, it's like they set up really early on. I don't know if you thought this, too, but definitely the first time I was watching this movie, the guy who basically, he's the building manager or something, he gives Lee a tour of the apartment before she buys it on the spot, pretty much, or rents it on the spot. And I thought they were setting him up to be the guy, because he obviously has that access, and he's never even brought up later on as a suspect or anything.
Right. You hardly ever see him. And I think at first it's something that she shrugs off, but it does escalate pretty quickly to the point of, you know, this guy is straight up terrorizing her. And I think it's when she first starts dating Paul, he notices that she looks really fatigued and stressed out. And same with Sophie. You know, there's a scene where they're both out to dinner and she's just like, I know something's going on. So she starts to tell them what's going on. And also another interesting element to this movie that I think is similar to Halloween, actually, is that when she first reaches out to the law enforcement about what's going on, I mean, they can't Charles really. Cyphers. Yeah, it's Charles Cyphers. But before Charles Cyphers even enters the frame, it's something to think about. You know, as the audience, you're watching it, going, "Oh my God, this person is clearly harassing her. She's clearly, like, in some kind of danger." But the police can't really do anything, because what can they do? Like, there no real threat has been made. It's like if you're just getting prank phone calls and random mail from somebody, there's nothing that the law enforcement can do to stop that.
I don't remember the exact line, but someone at the police station actually says that to her. Like, what did this guy do? And she says, well, he sent me some letters and invited me on a vacation and stuff like that. I'm like, that's not really an offense that we can prosecute, you know?
Yeah, and she even says at the end of that phone call, before she slams the phone down, I specifically remember her saying, well, when you find me dead, you'll be the first one to know, or something like that.
Yeah, exactly. So it's this thing where she is trying to also, you know, she's not only trying to find out for herself who this guy is, but she's also trying to get some evidence that they can do something with so that this will stop. And it's really hard, you know, I do think that's a very Halloween-like thing where she is trying to convince people of this threat that is out there and that is lurking and is looming, and she's just not able to do it. I mean, again, I think the police are spectacularly unhelpful in some of these Carpenter films, and I don't know if that's a theme or a commentary that runs through all of it, but, you know, we are kind of on our own in this world, and particularly this character, who is kind of just, like, beset from all sides. Nobody really wants to help her too much except for Paul and Sophie.
Yep, and this is an important movie. This is a very important movie because there's a lot of firsts here, right? It's like it's Carpenter's first time doing a TV movie. This is for him in his personal life, and I watched some of this in the interview. I mean, he literally met his future wife on the set of this movie, which is pretty big. And then Adrian would go on to star in The Fog and also Escape from New York, and we get our first repeat actor here with Charles Cyphers. As Charles Cyphers was obviously in Assault on Precinct 13, and then he's going to be sticking around this podcast for a while. He is one of Carpenter's go-to guys. He's his enforcer. He's the police officer. And in this movie, his character particularly annoys me because he's just super lazy and really doesn't want to have... I mean, at one point in this movie, they find a guy that's like a potential suspect, and he's just like a sort of sketchy person, and they ruin this guy's life. You know, they basically take his job and his pension from him, and they force him to move out of the state and live under all this like surveillance, and, you know, essentially he's on this probation. And as the audience, we kind of know right away that guy's not guilty. And when stalking continues and Lee tries to convey to Charles Cyphers' character, the police officer, that they got the wrong guy, he just doesn't even want to hear about it. He doesn't want to investigate any further. He's just like, whatever. You know, it's like, I mean, his character to me is it's Charles Cyphers. I love him as an actor, and he does very well with the role. But man, I'm so pissed at him in this movie for not looking into things any further than he bothers to.
I don't know. Do you agree with me though? Because that's what I think. That's something that he's doing very deliberately, and I think that's kind of a thing that runs throughout Carpenter. Is he doesn't have a lot of faith in institutions. You know, the police are kind of powerless. Yeah, even Assault in Precinct 13, right? Like, it's the criminals and this one really good cop who team up to defeat the bad guys in that movie, and a lot of the other police officers in that movie are kind of, you know, incompetent, or they're too slow, and they end up getting killed really early on, and that sort of carries through here. We need to talk about that character that you were just mentioning, the one who is basically the prime suspect in the stalking thing through most of the movie. Chris, did you recognize that guy? His name is Len Lesser, but do you know what his most famous role is?
I don't know who Len Lesser is. But I also am not, it happens very quickly in the movie. I mean, I know there's that scene where he's being interrogated by the police officer. I don't even really know what they have as evidence against him to be able to peg him for this crime.
Yeah, I'm not sure either. I think they're just looking for a guy. Len Lesser was Uncle Leo on Seinfeld. Were you a Seinfeld fan?
Oh my God. Yeah. Wow.
I love that character so much. He used to make me laugh on that show. Every time, you know, he was on, that was always a highlight of that show. Jerry. And when I saw him in this movie, like, there's a quick shot of him early on. I thought he was just going to be a sort of, you know, one scene kind of character. And he does play a slightly larger supporting role than I expected. We'd see a little bit more of him later in the film. But when they showed him the first time, I was like, is that Uncle Leo? And in my notes, literally in big, huge block capital letters, I've just got Uncle Leo and like 17 exclamation points. I was so excited to see him in this film.
That is really, really funny.
And he's very creepy. I mean, he's got this kind of hulking presence. I want to talk about that scene. Like, you know, should we get into a couple of scenes that we really like in this film? Because there's one that's not my favorite, but that's definitely one of the things that really made this feel like a proto Halloween to me, and really made this feel like the Carpenter movie that it actually is. What do you think is the best scene in this movie?
The best scene. I don't know if it's the best scene, but one of my favorite scenes is Lee comes home and there's a note on the door that says, "Meet me in the parking garage. I'll be here until this time." And she goes down there, and there's this great scene where, like, okay, so she, of course, takes a knife with her, you know, to have some kind of weapon, goes down in the parking garage, and she's kind of creeping around. The suspense at this point in the movie is really pretty good. She clumsily drops the knife through a grate, like, on the bottom, that's on the floor. And she's like, fuck, so I have to get, she has to get the knife. So she lifts up the grate cover and goes down into, goes underneath the floor. And that's when who you think at this point, who the audience thinks is the killer, comes around. So that scene where she's underneath the grate and he's just standing on top of her, like, smoking a cigarette, and, like, nothing's happening, and then he drops the cigarette, and it just lands right on her, and she walks away. And eventually, when the coast is clear, she comes out and walks out, and that's when she bumps into, actually, Len Lesser. I just think that whole scene is executed very well, and I thought the suspense there was really good. And again, man, I've got to hand it to Lauren Hutton, man. I think her acting in this movie is really good, and she, when she's afraid, I believe she's afraid, you know, and she's selling it pretty well.
Yeah, that's a great sequence. It's got a lot of that subjective camera that we see in Halloween, and just the staging of that, like you were saying, where she's underneath the grate and he drops the cigarette in there, and you kind of see this little reaction on her face like, oh, shit, am I going to catch fire right now? Like, yep. She has to be super quiet. He's standing right above her. And like I said, he's got this very sort of hulking presence, and he's standing right on top of her. And if he looks down at all, he's definitely going to see her. I mean, Carpenter establishes really well there that it's fairly well lit. I mean, it's a creepy setting. You know, it's this laundry room that she ends up in, and there's these wooden lockers on either side. I mean, I don't know exactly how that all works. Once again, laundry is associated with stalking, just like it is in Halloween. Those great moments in that detached laundry room that house has in Halloween.
Ooh, I didn't even think of that similarity.
Yeah, I don't know what the thing is there. Carpenter must have a real fear of laundry, or fear of doing the laundry. But
I hate doing laundry.
Shows up in this movie too. But yeah, I thought that scene was really, really well executed. Parking garages are pretty creepy anyway, so I don't know why she would agree to meet him down there. And it's sort of the first, like, major, like, extended suspense sequence in the movie. But there's one before that literally made me jump the first time I saw it. And I was so impressed by it, I went back and watched it, like, 6 times. And that is the scene, it's early, early on in the film. I want to say it's, like, maybe first 15, 20 minutes, where she is in her apartment and she's on the phone. And Lee, we're talking about. And this is where she thinks someone has broken in, and there's been a burglary of some kind. And she calls up, like, the building superintendent and is just trying to get some answers about it. And I guess he says they installed something in her apartment, and she says they left the door open. And the guy says, no, I was here. The door was definitely closed when we left. And so we get these shots of her. They're kind of medium shots. She's on the phone. The camera's circling around her really slowly, which is just sort of a common camera move that we see in lots of things, and we're not really set up for too much with that, and it's not an angle, doesn't look like it's anybody's POV or anything like that, so it gives us just a moment to breathe. And then the camera kind of just, like, slowly drifts, like, around her a little bit, so we can see the living room, and bam, this guy runs by in the background out of nowhere. He must have been hiding in a corner or something.
Yes.
And then just disappears and slams the door, and she doesn't notice until he slams the door. And, like, my heart just, like, I mean, you know, it skipped a beat there a little bit. I wasn't expecting that at all. It was a much scarier scene that, I don't know, I kind of went into this expecting a TV movie where the scares would be really telegraphed a lot. And that one I thought was not. It was beautifully set up. The conversation she's having on the phone is so boring and so like kind of, you know, just lulls you into complacency. And then bam, this thing happens. And it just really, it kind of, you know, I'm not sure I liked this movie until I hit that point. And I was like, all right, we are in the hands of a master here. This is Carpenter, maybe not at his best, but this is Carpenter doing what he does best.
Yeah, and well, I mean, again, working in that environment for the first time, you know, the first time working with a union, the first time working with the television studio. I mean, it had to be, again, it's like that's your learning experience, you know. I think this whole movie was shot in like 18 days. One scene that really startled me is just that when she's in her car and she gets startled by that random like hobo or something like that.
Oh, I really like this scene. Like, there's some weird choices that this movie makes, but yeah. So she's just finished up a date with Paul and gets back in her car, and this guy. Hold on, I have it written down here. There's a line here that kind of makes no sense, but I like it anyway.
Yeah, that scene. It still, every time, like, they timed it in a way that just really jolts you, you know?
Yeah, like, well, she's outside the car at first. She's, we do get a POV shot there. Like, someone is watching her in that scene also. And then she sort of gets wind of that a little bit, gets in her car, and someone bangs on the window, and it's this weird homeless guy, and he just says, "Hell of a life." And then just like, I don't know what that means. I don't know what he's referring to there. And she gets scared, obviously. And then he just kind of walks away. And the music that this film plays when the guy walks away, it's so strange. It almost sounds like an old circus movie, like the elephant music, like this kind of brum, 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 brum. I'm like, what is that? Carpenter did not do the music for this movie, by the way.
I was just going to say it was done by a man named... is it Harry Sukman?
Yeah, I don't know how to pronounce the name.
Yeah, and the music's not bad.
No, it's not Carpenter good, but it does, in some sense, have a little bit of a Carpenter vibe, but not in that scene. I don't know what that musical choice is. The opening credit song that is played in this movie, that's very Carpenter-esque, and it's got these really cheesetastic 1970s TV movie opening credits that I like a lot.
Yeah, the graphics are so ridiculously poor. Like, when it says someone's watching me on the screen, you're just like, oh my god. It really sets the tone for, like, you know, what we're in for here, I guess.
Yeah, and especially, you know, compared to like the very, very cinematic opening credits of something like Halloween that we were talking about on those episodes, where they're just very sort of elegant looking and they really set the tone for the movie. And this kind of like, I mean, it's effective in that I sort of like that it sets up the building, and it kind of makes a visual match with that shot of the building that we get kind of looking up at it, that very ominous dolly shot where we're looking up at the windows of this building from down on the street. But they are so cheesy, and even the music there, you know, it kind of really gets rip-roaring in a way that Carpenter soundtracks generally do not.
Rip roaring.
It almost sounds like the A-Team or something.
Yeah, it's a little, the music is definitely a little over the top in to a certain degree in some spots.
But that's the thing about this movie. Like, there are some concessions to what you would do in a TV movie, right? Like, some of the camera work is very, like, let's just push in on the characters here. And a lot of it does feel like a television show. But then what kind of makes that work is that there's also these very Carpenter-esque shots in it throughout. And they're not the most common things. I mean, he had to work quickly, so he was kind of going with this very conventional TV style for most of it. But then you do get some signature Carpenter stuff, and it really stands out here. Like in that cold open we were talking about, there's this great sort of pull back across the length of the telescope where we're seeing the stalker really early on, and this really like oppressive looking phallic telescope, and this very, very slow pull back along the length of it. And I'm like, oh yeah, that looks like a thing that Carpenter would do. It gets conventional later on, but we do see the POV stuff that we were talking about, like in the laundry room / parking garage sequence. I think that feels very Carpenter, very Halloween, especially. So, you know, it almost is like when we get those Carpenter moments in the midst of this very sort of conventional TV stuff, they make us kind of sit up and take notice. The scene I was just talking about where the guy runs across the frame in the background, that is framed in a very TV sort of style. And then this very cinematic horror thing happens in that scene, and it's a real shock there.
Yeah, I think there's a lot in the lens that is appropriate. I mean, the movie is, again, was initially called High Rise. The fact that she's in a high rise apartment is one of the key elements to the story. So there's a lot of scenes that just start off with a camera, you know, panning across up and down, you know, vertically these buildings to give you an idea of how many stories they are. There's a lot that we see just through the lens of the telescope. There's a lot of moving telescope shots, as you would expect. And, yeah, like, I think the cinematography in this, overall is pretty good. Like, it's a fairly, well shot movie. And I think there's a lot of camera movements, if you will, that, like, even John Carpenter himself was talking about this. Like, he learned how to film a few things within the frame that he would later end up applying to Halloween and other movies like that. So again, this is still, I mean, if you look at Dark Star as the student film, Assault on Precinct 13 as, like, you know, the low budget feature film, and then this, a TV movie, I mean, this is still very, very early on in his career. So I think that we're going to see that things are executed with a little bit more, what's the word I'm looking for? Experience later on in his films, obviously, but I think it's a pretty good looking picture.
Yeah, I mean, in some ways it is. It's also, I mean, it's a short shooting schedule. I'm sure the budget was not huge on this. I mean, he's working within constraints here that he doesn't have. I mean, obviously the violence is sort of toned down. We don't get anything quite as brutal as what we see in Assault in Precinct 13 or Halloween, anything like that, but you know, I think he makes the most of this, and he does get a lot of his signature stuff in, whether it's the Hawksian dialogue that I didn't particularly like, but you know, is definitely distinctly Carpenter. The POV shots are distinctly Carpenter. I think he does a thing here that we don't always see, is that he really builds tension in a way that is very effective. And of course, we see that a lot in Halloween. But, you know, there's later films of his that are more go for broke. They're a little more impatient than this, I feel like. Whereas this one knows how to steadily just increase the stakes and increase the tension. And I mean, you can tell it's a learning experience for him. You can tell that it's a step in his evolution and things that we, you know, take for granted later on, because, you know, he does become this master of horror, quote unquote, you know, that we get them in kind of a prototypical form in this movie. I really like the, yes, the climax, like that final confrontation where Lee basically is, she's in her apartment and this guy is there and he's not coming out. You know, he's not someone that attacks you. He's someone who hides. And she basically says, "Face me." Like, it's this really nice sort of tough woman moment, very much like you'd see in Halloween with Laurie Strode, where she's really just taking control of the situation, and it's like, no, like, be a man, stand up here and let me see your face.
Right, so let's try to complete, like, the plot to this, because we talked about, you know, how she gets these weird gifts in the mail, and this guy's breaking in and out of her apartment. I mean, at one point, the police have arrested somebody who is, what is the gentleman's name again? I already forget. Oh, Len Lesser.
Just call him Uncle Leo. I call him Uncle Leo.
He gets arrested, and the police are ready to close the case on this thing. And then, of course, after that, she realizes that she's still being stalked, because she gets another phone call. She gets another note at the house. And
the guy basically gets deported to another state, which I don't know if that's a thing.
Des Moines, Iowa.
Yeah, he gets sent to Des Moines and shipped off, and he, like, can't come back. And there's, like, not that much evidence against him. It's a strange sort of legal setup there. But yeah, I mean, we think the movie is over, essentially. I mean,
dude, at one point they say that he lost his job and his pension. And I'm like, wow, I'm like, that is harsh, man. Like,
and it's never resolved later in the film either. So that guy could just be stranded in Des Moines with no money money and no job, and he didn't do anything wrong. He's a gardener. He's just basically going around tending his plants in his apartment, like kind of keeping to himself, doing his laundry. You know, he's a good citizen, and he gets kind of thrown under the bus here.
Yeah, and at some point, like, basically everyone's starting to look at Lee like she's the crazy one to a certain point. They're like, you know, even her boyfriend Paul is like, really? Like, I guess I still believe you, sort of thing. Because they thought they really had this thing wrapped up. And that's when we show that Paul generally really does care about her. And he's like, you know what? Let's get deeper into this investigation. And that's when they go to the city and start asking questions about, he's like, he fronts like he's, you know, writing an article about, I don't know, what is it, like property maintenance or something like that. And they're able to get some information about this guy who is, that's something that John Carpenter kind of adds into this movie in the script, is that, you know, this person is not just you know, some creep with a telescope living in the building across the way. He is a maintenance man.
City employee, right? He's like a decorated city employee. Like, when they find out who he is, and his boss is just like, oh yeah, he's a great guy. He's been working here for 40 years or something. And he's the only inspector. He's like a building inspector. And he's the only one that could possibly be doing, you know, he must cover the whole city or something like that, which I don't understand how the city of Los Angeles could only have one guy that does that job. But it makes it very easily for them to figure out who he is.
Nick, not a lot of people lived there yet in the late 70s. It was just a no. small rural community. That becomes a whole device in this movie where they're able to sort of to justify, and I'm glad they at least do that, how this guy is pulling off all these pranks and has access to everything. And then that leads us to the unfortunate scene with Sophie, as you were saying, where she gets killed off. And, I mean, it's like, you know, Lee Michaels just out of nowhere is sort of, well, not out of nowhere, but she kind of sporadically decides to just go across the way into the other building and break into this guy's room. And she wants Sophie to watch her through her telescope to make sure that she's okay. And while she does that, of course, the killer goes to Lee's room, breaks in, and kills Sophie. And this is something that Lee witnesses through the telescope. They were communicating by walkie-talkie, and we also learn at some point that it wasn't just the gifts and the spying, but this guy had, like, surveillance. He had, like, recording units in Lee's apartment. So, I mean, he could literally hear all her conversations and dialogue and things like that.
Yeah, like, we know the place is bugged really early on, right? Like, I think that's, right. You know, the scene I was talking about when she's on the phone and the guy runs by in the back of the frame, he's planting a bug there, and we do see it. There's a cool shot that kind of, like, just descends under the table it's like it's sitting on under a desk, and there's a shot that kind of moves under the desk, and we can see it's a very obvious bug, by the way. I don't know how she didn't spot it. It's like the size of a golf ball or something like that. I mean, it's something that if you reached under the desk at all, you would definitely feel it. You'd probably hear some feedback from it or something. So I'm not sure exactly how that works. But I mean, he's recording everything. He's keeping very detailed logs of his stalking of this woman. It kind of reminded me, like, you know, there's a lot of, as you were saying, we see a lot of shots of recording devices in this film, like reel-to-reel tape and stuff like that. And, right. Like, that was a huge thing in thrillers in the 70s, right? Like, it's the Watergate era, and, you know, you got movies like Clute and The Conversation, which are all about this surveillance equipment and surveillance technology. Like, people were very concerned about that back then, you know, specifically in that, like, Watergate era where things could really escalate based on recordings. You know, if you have recorded evidence of something or you have recordings of something, you have a lot of power. That's really emphasized in this film. So that's kind of a neat thematic thing that it does.
Yeah, absolutely. And I've got to say, man, like, you talked about this a little bit before, but I think we should embellish on it. Like, not just the decision to have Sophie killed off, which also, if you think about it, is really dark, because we never even find out, like, what happened to her. Like, it's not like he killed her and just left the body there. It's like the body's missing.
That's true. That's an unresolved plot point. Totally. I mean, it's maybe she's not even dead, although it looks like she's dead.
Yeah, and I don't know how Cyphers comes up with that bullshit story, like how this guy was able to orchestrate, like, oh yeah, she hopped on a flight to Dallas or whatever this morning, and it all checks out, and here's the confirmation number, and they're going to call. I was just like, how is this guy, I assume since he was working for the city, he was just, I don't know, he basically is playing everyone out in this conspiracy.
Well, she did have the plane tickets already. She was planning on leaving the city. So, I mean, it's kind of hand waved away. I agree with that. But there is, you know, she's getting a job in Fort Worth, I think it was. And she's finally decided, all right, I'm really going to go. And, you know, she's there helping Lee this one last time, basically, before she takes off.
Oh, I see. Yeah. Because Lee's like, bullshit. I saw it with my own eyes. You know, like, I saw it happen. And that is a pretty cool shot where, you know, she goes back in the apartment and her bathroom mirror is all fogged up and it has written on there, no one believes you.
Yeah. I mean, those sequences are really good, like where they're looking back and forth at each other from the opposite buildings. I mean, it's well done. And like I said earlier, it's very Hitchcockian with the telescope and the sort of voyeurism aspect of it. But I don't know. I feel really, really bad for this character who just sort of she's the only one who dies. She's the only innocent person who dies in the movie.
Sophie.
Right.
Yeah. And this is what I'm saying is that the thing that I take issue with is like, the timing, the way that's filmed, like, it's so annoying, you know, because the killer comes in, we do see a kind of frightening scene of his shadow, and he just grabs her and starts strangling her, but Lee's response to it is so just, you know, she's like looking through the telescope at what's happening, seeing that Sophie's clearly being attacked, and saying, what's going on? What's going on? You know, and I'm sitting there watching it going, no way, you know, like if you saw that, you would be beelining it out of there like within half a second. And she, it just, I don't know. And then by the time she gets there, obviously it's too late. There's no sign of Sophie. Everything was recorded on audio.
Do you think, I'm sorry to like harp on this, like, when you see a scene like that in a movie, a lot of times it's kind of implicating the audience. Like, she's looking through this telescope, her friend is getting brutally killed, and she kind of does nothing about it. And, you know, of course, the cliche about that is, well, that's talking about all of us, right? Like, we love seeing violence from far away. Like, we go to the movies to see these horrific things happen. And, you know, would we actually do something in real life, you know, if we were in a situation like that? Or do we kind of like to watch? I mean, you know, I think Hitchcock obviously got those themes across a lot better, but you know, I'm not sure, maybe he's just sort of paying homage to that kind of thematic thing that we've seen in a lot of Hollywood thrillers and a lot of mystery suspense type movies like this. I mean, maybe I'm just justifying a sort of poor plot choice here.
No, I think that's an extremely interesting take analytically on that. I mean, either it was or it wasn't, you know, we'll never know. But that's the one thing about that scene that sort of annoys me a little bit, is not that she could have done anything from where she was, but the whole, like, what's happening, like, as you're clearly watching someone get killed, it's like, well, you know, I don't know, you know what's happening. So, and then there's another scene. So this is a question I have for you. At one point, because a lot of things happen in the last, like, 20 minutes of this movie. It's like she goes to somehow finds out where this guy lives and just takes a cab there, breaks the window, and just breaks into his house. Because when she first goes into the apartment and sees all the surveillance equipment, you know, sees his documents on his log, if you will, on every time he called her. She knows that she's in the right apartment building. Of course, when the police show up, all the equipment's been conveniently moved.
Yep.
There's no sign of it. So somehow figures out where this guy lives and just straight up breaks in his house. By the way, I love how she's smoking a cigarette in this guy's house, like, while she just breaks in. It's like, that's so weird how in the 70s that was just like what people did everywhere they went. But Yeah, she finds all the same equipment there. That's another good scare that's placed in this movie, is right before she's about to leave, she turns around and the cab driver just standing right there. And he's like, oh, did you forget your keys? You know what I mean? Or yeah, it's, whatever it is.
Kind of poorly set up jump scare, but I think I did jump a little bit.
Yeah. And I don't know. I just thought that was also a little over the top, how she just has a, you know, hey, taxi. Take me to this house here. All right, I'm going to smash that window and you know, I'll be in here snooping around for a little while. Don't mind me. And, yeah, I clearly didn't have my keys, so I broke the window. Hey, I got to go. You need a lift? Yes. Take me to the tower, you know, or whatever. I mean, it was just, I don't know. I don't think that was the best put together scene, but it has to be there to establish that we know for a fact that, A, she's not crazy, and B, this guy was able to move all the evidence from his apartment before the police could find any of it. So he's a this guy's pretty crafty. He's a crafty one.
Yeah, he is. You know, it's kind of a boring job that he has, and he's been working at it for a very, very long time. So he's had a lot of time to sort of plot out all his nefarious deeds, I feel like, while he's just working for the city.
Right, which leads us to the final scene, because at that point she goes home and it looks like he's crafted like a suicide note for her.
Oh, that's a very, very creepy moment. I really liked that, where she comes home and finds that, and you know, this little note on her coffee table that says, you know, I don't want to live in this world anymore, or something like that. Like, it's I don't know that I've ever seen that in a movie before, where someone comes home and finds a staged suicide scene. I'm sure it's been done. I don't know if it had been done before this, but that got under my skin a little bit.
Yep. Yep. And so she knows that he's hiding there somewhere in the apartment, which is also a super creepy thing to, like, know that there's somebody there just waiting to, you know, lurking or whatever. And eventually he jumps out and they're scrapping with each other. And basically Lee is about to get, it looks like he's trying to push her over the balcony. And of course they're at a height where, if anybody fell off the balcony, their body would just explode on impact.
We don't get to see that in this TV movie.
We don't get to see that in this TV movie. Yeah. If we were in the, you know, late 80s, early 90s era of Carpenter's movies, we would probably, he probably would have went ahead and shown that. But yeah, like basically she's able to pull a piece of glass out of the window frame that's just hanging there. Over and over again, we see attempts of her trying to grab it unsuccessfully. And she stabs the dude and pushes him over the balcony, basically, right? Or she doesn't even push him. He just, like, falls over it.
Well, she stabs him, and then he's, like, lunging at her, and she kind of gets out of the way and just
ends up... That's what it is.
Yeah. I mean, it's pretty neat the way that's all set up, and that's a tense climax for the movie. And the movie just ends. You know, we don't really get any resolution to the few lingering plot threads that we have there. And what is the... She has, like, a little bit of a one-liner at the end. I don't remember exactly what it was. It's nothing, nothing spectacular.
She says, you got too close.
You got too close, exactly, which is kind of cool thematically, right? Like, you know, he has all this power at a distance, but, you know, like I was saying earlier, when she gets into the apartment and she just is not going to take this anymore, I love this kind of, you know, I mean, the character has been tough and she's made tough choices all along, but now it's just like, you know, let's do this thing. Like, let's go mano a mano, and you know, I like the confidence that she has there, and it pays off, right? It, you know, finally, when he gets in close enough to actually attack her, she gets the upper hand on him and sort of wins the day.
Yeah, and I think ultimately this movie did do a few things for John Carpenter. I mean, I was reading on Wikipedia that it was nominated for the Edgar Award for Best Television Feature or Miniseries 1979. I mean, that's something, you know what I mean? Like, it was definitely recognized as being a decent piece of film. And from there, again, was largely never, I mean, there was such a scarcity of, like, physical copies of this available for a long, long time. So I think now that we're kind of in this Carpenter sance that we're going through right now, literally, Scream Factory put out the Blu-ray just last year, And I've noticed a lot of people are starting to kind of pay more attention to this movie because it's always been labeled as the forgotten Carpenter film.
Yeah, and I mean, I've seen this with filmmakers before where there's this like hard to find movie and the fans are all just sort of clamoring for it and they all want to know, you know, what it is and whether it's a lost classic, quote unquote, whether it's something that, you know, really can stand with the best of his work. And I don't think this is that. I mean, I think if you're going to, especially if you're going to purchase that fancy Blu-ray that you have, you know, go into this knowing that it is nowhere near the best Carpenter film. It's nowhere near him sort of working at the top of his powers. He really does have to concede a lot to the TV format and the censorship and everything like that. I mean, there are moments. I do think if you're a Carpenter fan, you should check this movie out. I liked it more than I disliked it. I mean, there were things about it that really impressed me. There were things about it that really disappointed me, but
it's good.
I mean, it's not a lost masterpiece, but it is a fairly good movie. And, you know, I always try to, and we've said this on the show before, when I see a film like this, I try to put myself in the shoes or in the mindset of somebody seeing it in the era when it came out the first time. Like, can you imagine watching this like on a Sunday night on TV and like, you know, you and your family probably even bring the kids down to watch it, whatever, because, you know, it's on TV. It'll be fine. They won't be scared by this. And, you know, the whole family just sort of gathered around the very small CRT tube and watching this film that does have some pretty good Carpenter quality scares in it and everything like that. And I feel like this would have probably left a pretty strong impression on people. I know, you know, if you're like a 6 or 7 year old watching this movie and then you have memories of it later on, right? Like, that's a thing that I don't think happens so much anymore. But there's all these stories I've read online of people who, you know, they're remembering these creepy TV movies, the stuff they just happened to catch on TV when they were kids, and it like scarred them for life, and they don't remember exactly what it was, and they're trying to find like the name of this movie. And I feel like this could have definitely worked for that, right? Like, I feel like a lot of kids saw this movie in the late 70s, were scared by it, it got kind of unnerved by it, forgot about it for a long time, and then, you know, maybe they would, sometimes that image, like, flashes into your head, like that guy running through the apartment in the back of the frame, or that scene where she's trapped under the grate, and later on you'd be like, oh, that was a really scary movie, what was that? And, you know, until now, you probably wouldn't be able to have found out what it is.
Yep. That's a great point. And if anything, you know, it had to be a just a good year for John Carpenter as far as just in his, you know, artistic journey that he was on, you know, to have Halloween drop and then also put out this project. I mean, no matter how you slice it, it's two movies in 1 year.
I'd be interested to know how he felt, right? Like, so Halloween comes out a week before this. It's obviously a much, much better movie and becomes kind of a legendary movie. And then this one a week later is kind of like a stepping stone to that. And like, do you think he had just completely moved on at that point and he was just focused on, you know, how is Halloween doing? Can I make more movies like that? Rather than, you know, or I don't know. I'd be interested to know his thoughts on just like where he was at on the night this premiered and you know, how he felt about working in the TV, because he didn't make a lot of TV movies overall, but he definitely did return to that format a few times. And then kind of when he did Masters of Horror in the early 2000s, he almost came back and was sort of paying tribute to his days as a TV film director rather than a theatrical director.
Yeah, it was a TV. It was his first shot at TV with a suspense film vehicle, whatever you want to call it. And I'll tell you that on the special features, there are interviews with John Carpenter. There's one with Charles Cyphers and also Adrian Barbeau. And I get the impression that they're all, like, looking back, they're all very proud of this film and had, you know, I didn't detect any. In particular, because, I mean, John Carpenter is he's brutally honest about, you know, his opinions and the way, like, if something comes out not good and he thinks it's not good, he'll just straight up say it. But he was, I think part of it is, like, that whole, there's probably a lot of nostalgia in this for him. Again, this is the film where he met his wife. It was early on in his career. Halloween's happening, so it's, like, it's him kind of, like, right at the foothold of like this massive amount of success. And being that it was, I've used this term a lot, but it's learning experience. I think that he probably looks back at it, with optimism, you know, and it's probably has a lot of fond memories of doing these works early on in his career. So, I mean, he probably knows it's not a 4-star movie, but again, working within the constraints that they had to, as you were saying, I think it's worth a watch. You know, like, I would tell anybody, yeah, watch this movie, but I would never say, oh, you have to see Someone's Watching Me, you know what I mean? Unless, if you are the Carpenter completist, it's definitely worth it.
Yeah, I mean, that's it. It's definitely for the completist. No one's going to see this and be like, oh, that's just as good as Halloween. I mean, no one should be expecting. I don't think anyone is expecting that, right? But
then again, what is?
These sort of, right, exactly. Well, he's made some other movies that are up to that level. This is not one of them. But I think, you know, a film like this gets a mystique over the years. Like, you know, it's this hidden thing and, all, you know, people haven't seen it in so long. And what if it is kind of a lost masterpiece? And, you know, I think that's just being a little too harsh on a movie like this. I mean, it's good for what it is, and it does some things really well. I was actually looking at an interview with Adrienne Barbeau about this, and she was talking about how this film really helped her transition from being basically a television actress and that style of acting to being more of a film actress. You know, she basically says Carpenter told her to take it down a notch a little bit.
Yes.
And do things in a slightly more subtle way, and I think her performance in this movie is really, really good, but you can definitely see an evolution. You know, as she sort of moves forward into the later Carpenter films that she really does dial it back a lot and becomes, I think, a much better and more subtle and more, you know, humanistic and naturalistic actress in that process. So, you know, it's a stepping stone. It's a learning experience for her also. Adrienne Barbeau she's still alive. She's doing great. She was in the first episode of Creepshow and I thought was very, very good in it. It's nice to see her still around and still doing horror and, you know, just she seems like a really, really nice person. She's really, you know, one of those genre actresses who's really flourished and has sort of made a name for herself with the fans and has been really gracious and really cool about that. But we are a John Carpenter podcast and until he, like, I would love, they did renew Creepshow for another season. I think he would be the perfect guy to do an episode of that show. You know, I'd actually like to see him do both stories and you know, just kind of explore some things. He probably has some short scripts lying around that he's not doing anything with, and you know, if the producers of Creepshow are listening right now, and we know they are, you know, guys, give John Carpenter a shot next season. At any rate, Chris, any final thoughts about Someone's Watching Me? I think we covered this movie pretty well. I think this might be the longest conversation anyone's ever had about Someone's Watching Me.
I don't know. That's possible. No, I don't really have anything else to say other than I am very pleased that we're sticking to the game plan, which is to do every Carpenter film in chronological order, meaning, Nick, what are we going to be talking about next time?
I actually don't know.
Oh, well, I can tell you then.
Because I was going to say The Fog, but I think I'm wrong about that.
I believe we have one more to do before The Fog. And this is, this is just so strange. The next Carpenter movie is another TV movie, and it is Elvis.
Oh, is it time for Elvis? Great.
It is time for Elvis. And I'm just going to give you a heads up. We're really going to have to carve out some time to watch it. It is a 3-hour movie. So, and this is going to be, I think, quite a long discussion because not only is there a lot to talk about, but it's also the first time that Carpenter works together with Kurt Russell. And I've only seen it once myself, so I definitely need to watch it again before we record the episode.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to it. I mean, probably not my genre exactly, but I do love Kurt Russell, and I'm interested to see his Elvis impersonation. So that should be fun. Like, later on, did you ever see the movie 3,000 Miles to Graceland?
No.
It's this terrible, trashy action movie from, like, the early 2000s where I believe he plays an Elvis impersonator in it. So maybe it's a little homage to that early work with Carpenter. At any rate, we hope you've enjoyed this episode. If you want to get in touch with us, you can contact us via email at precinct13podcast@gmail.com. We are on Twitter at 13precinct. That is 13precinct. Facebook.com/13precinct. Our show's official official website where you can download all of our episodes, find all the subscription links, is precinct13.simplecast.com. We would love to hear from you. Let us know how we're doing. Let us know what you would like to hear. Let us know your thoughts on Someone's Watching Me. You know, if there's a rabid super fan of this movie out there, we would love to hear from you. Same goes for Elvis or any of the other ones. We will talk to you again soon. I have been Nick. He has been Chris. Enjoy your Carpenter movies. Enjoy your post-Halloween season. We will be back to talk about Elvis in 2 weeks.